Well, after a six-week gap, Tim's been on holiday, you know. Here we are again. It's On the Front Foot from Susie 103.4, our cricket chat show. Hello, good evening. My name's David Jay. Delighted to say that we've two guests this evening. Very shortly, Lewis Hatchett from East Grinstead, who've just won the Sussex Premier League. And later on, James Leck is coming in to have a chat with us about his first season as master in charge at the grammar school in Reigate. And we're going to be rambling across not just the doings of East Grinstead and Reigate Grammar School. We're going to be having a good look at all things cricket as a prelude to what we hope will be a second show later on this month. Now, if you'd like to get in touch with the show, I have to tell you once again that we're not fortunate enough to have a telephonist or receptionist with us here tonight. So if you need to contact the show in the next couple of hours, we're here till 9, will you please text us? And that'll pop up on the screen on my right-hand side. Our text number in the studio is 07480 025 010. Or you could email studio at susyradio.com, that's S-U-S-Y radio, all one word. Right, we're going to move on into the show, and our first track this evening is especially for East Grinstead Cricket Club. Well, if not of the world, of the Sussex Premier League at least, and we'll be welcoming Lewis Hatchett to the studio in just a moment. But before we do that, there's one final report. And our last cricket report of the season is Hawley under-21s, who lost a nail-biting Surrey Trust League final by one run when they were bowled out for 95 in 33 overs and 3 balls in reply to Dorking's 96 in 37 overs and 5 balls. With autumn well underway at Normandy Cricket Club, Hawley put Dorking in and reduced them to 25 for 4, with 2 wickets apiece for skipper Charlie Robbins and Sam Renfrey. Ben Rogers then top-scored for Dorking with 24 and Charlie Edwards made 15, but no one else got to double figures as Stuart McPherson took 3 for 11 and Jordan Robbins picked up 2 wickets plus a run out. But with just 95 to chase, no one in the Hawley lineup reached 20. McPherson and Sam Renfrey at 6 and 7 both made 18 before Charlie Edwards dismissed them to end up as Dorking's match winner with 5 for 16, including a hat-trick. Well, Tim, you've made it back from London, okay?
Yes, managed to get back all right tonight, no problem.
It's good to see you, and are you well?
Yes, I'm fine, thank you. All rested after my holiday.
I was going to say, you enjoyed it with Malaysia,
it
yes?
It was, that's right, Borneo, yeah, it was good fun.
Do they play cricket in Borneo?
I don't know, they weren't. I didn't see any evidence of it, I have to say, but we were in sort of most of the holiday, we were halfway through the jungle, so it was not much chance of much cricket there.
Right you are. Lewis Hatchett from East Grinstead Cricket Club, champions indeed. Good evening to you, and welcome to Susie 103.5.
Good evening, gents. Thank you very much for having me.
It's absolutely lovely to see you here. Now, clearly, congratulations are in order. Champions indeed. Lewis, is this the first time for East Grinstead?
Yeah, it's the first time we've won the league as a club, so it's been a very, very special year. Everyone from right from the juniors all the way up. We had a really good end-of-season awards only a couple of weeks ago, and it was a great celebration. You could just see how much everyone at the club really meant to them. Just the guys that have put in the work. Especially guys, gents like Andy Hayes and Jeff Border, they've really put in us so much work over the years on the ground and everything behind the scenes. And for those guys to see us win the league, it was incredible. And then, yeah, it was a very special year.
So tell us what it takes to win the Sussex Premiership.
Literally, tactically, it takes a really consistent team. I think we've seen Roffey, who have won it the last 3 years. They've had a team that hadn't changed. I think they probably rotated about 14 players in the whole year, and probably our downfall in those years when Roffey were winning it, because we had a not too dissimilar squad. We just lacked the availability. We had guys who were coming in and out, For all sorts of reasons, you can't really help that, and you can't force people to be on a cricket field at all. It's still, they're not being paid. It's part of their enjoyment. So, but this year we really sat down at the start of the year. We're very fortunate. We had a lot more availability, but we sat down as a team, and we said, right, this is our year. We really did nail this year and say this was going to be the year. If there's any year we're going to do it, it's going to be this year. And we need to keep a tight core group of a squad, and we managed to. People, naturally you lose people here and there, but it gave us real strength and depth in the whole of the club. Once we had a solid, I'd say about 14 players come around the first team, we were then able to see a bit more strength in the second team. Guys were playing more regularly there. There weren't people coming in doing the odd jobs. You may have a youth guy come up from the second team, a young bowler, and they get an opportunity. They get straight away, they get the bowl. We also saw the change of the format this year. Went from the old 58-52 split and time you can draw and all that, which a general feel of the league is that they don't like it. And they brought in 50-over cricket, half and half throughout the year. So half the games were 50-over, and that really suited our team because we had a strong bowling team. And I think that fundamentally is how you win a league. You have to have a very strong bowling team. I'm biased because I am a bowler, but you do have to have a strong bowling team. You have to be able to take all the wickets, otherwise you're not going to win the game. So, yeah, we were able to have a very strong bowling lineup that we had about six or seven bowlers that people were having to try and figure out how to score runs against.
Tell us about the makeup. Tell us about your front-line bowlers in the first 11 at East Grinstead.
Well, if he is listening, Ian Sturmer's going to want to be named as the number one bowler, but I'm going to say that I'm the number one bowler for sure. But yeah, we there's myself, Ian Sturmer, Finn Hudson-Prentice, who was of Sussex as well. We have Will Adkin, my brother Brad Hatchett, he's one of our spinners. We have Ollie Graham, who, again, Brad and Ollie will fight for who's the supreme off-spinner in the team. And then we have guys who can actually do a job. Daryl Rebbitz, the ex-captain from last year, and he's a handy bowler. And then, like I said, we have young guys coming up who are doing a good job in the twos, and then they get a chance in the ones, and that's their time. So.
How long has East Grinstead been in the Premier League?
Oh, blimey. Well, I've played for the club for 9 years now, and we've only ever been in the Premier League.
So you've always been in the Premier League. But
as far as I'm aware, I mean, you need someone who was potentially there a lot longer than me to tell you.
In your time
how long
that you've been there, what's the highest position you've finished before this season?
Second, yeah. I mean, we've finished second a couple of times, and we've always been near there. I think 3 years ago, we finished second by 2 points, which is literally your bonus point. That's like another 25 runs or something like that. And we were 2 points behind Roffey leading into seven games for the end of the season. And we went toe-to-toe with Roffey. And we both got 30 points every game. And they just didn't fold at all. It was amazing. And we won 10 games in a row that season and still came second. We thought that was going to be our year, but no, this year was when we really went, if we're going to win it, this is going to be our time, and next year's even more crucial now to retain it.
It's interesting to me, Lewis, as well, that in terms of successful sides in the Sussex Premiership, which, even though I'm Surrey-based, I keep an eye, obviously, and the more so since we've been featuring East Grinstead in our reports this season, it's interesting to me that you've got clubs like Roffey and Cookfield, maybe, who wouldn't traditionally back down the years necessarily have been thought of as big clubs, but which are really successful.
Yeah, definitely. Roffey, for us, have been a real standout. And like I said, they've been very good with their consistency of players, the people they put out. They've got a really tight-knit group of young lads. They're sort of around their mid-20s, and that's very similar to our age group of our team now. You get guys like that, they don't have necessary family commitments, and they can turn out every week. Roffey have just managed to keep that same squad. They've had a overseas come in and out, and they've got strong batters who they just know their game, really. They really know they can get runs should they bowl a team out, or they can set a target and then their spinners or their seamers can bowl a side out. They really know how to play the game well, and we basically knew how to do that. We found our way this year, and that's how we won.
It's interesting, isn't it, that when we've been doing the show over the summer, the clubs that come in, or the people that come in from the clubs which are successful, tend to be the ones that talk about availability and that they've got that core of players.
Yeah,
it's interesting. You talk about that at East Grinstead and at Roffey as well. That, you, that there's that core of players of a certain age which are, they're prepared to turn out every single week. And you, if you keep that and you've got the talent, you're going to be successful.
Yeah, I have no doubt that there'd be more than one club around the country having the same discussion, saying availability. And it's tough. Like cricket is cricket in general, sort of on a broad spectrum, it's going through that period where people are finding other things to do. It's not attracting as many people as we want, especially young people. So 2020 shortening the game. I think, like I said, that the our league introducing the 50 over comp will attract more people to it because you can. You start earlier. We started earlier this year, which was brilliant. It means you can add the social element into the cricket. I think that was had been lost definitely in the last sort of 5 to 6 years.
We can go three ways from here, really. So before we go to the social element and perhaps then think about the depth of East Grinstead and indeed your setup for your youngsters, just tell us about this tremendously successful National Cup run as well.
Yeah, we managed to reach the last four in the country. It was something that the club had never done. I think previously we'd got to the last 16. And, yeah, along with this brilliant run in the league we had, we managed to reach the final four. Unfortunately, lost in the semi-final to a very good team that once did in Snaresbrook. And they had a very strong team. But, yeah, we saw that as potentially being the cherry on top for our year. We didn't really see that as our goal for the start of the year. Our goal was to win the league. I even was saying to guys that our goal is to win the league here, and if we get as far as we get in the national, so be it. But the way we were playing and the team that we were turning out, it just kept going off. Our good form kept running on, and yeah, we just kept bowling sides out. I think that was our biggest strong point. I think throughout the whole year, no team got above. Two teams, maybe three teams, got above 200 against us. So we fundamentally knew we get 200, we got a good chance of winning the game. So and that we took that into every game that we went into, especially into the cup. We didn't really care who we were coming up against. We backed ourselves massively.
And you rolled the West Country's finest. It was Bath, I think, was it, in the quarter?
Yeah, that was one hell of an outfit, the Bath. They were really impressive when they came up. They stayed the night before. They were up crack of Sparrows straight at the ground, and with all the sort of balls and cones everywhere, and really is professional outfit. I mean, and then to hear that they'd been in that National Cup, I think in the quarterfinals 8 times, the semifinals 5, the final 3 times. They haven't won it. I can't believe they haven't won it. But they were a really strong team, and that was a great game. That's probably one of the best games of cricket I played at club level this year. Just the way it was played, like this quality of players, and it was such a nice day as well. It was a really, really good day.
You imply by your attitude to what Bath did and didn't do that perhaps East Grinstead takes it in a tiny bit more of a relaxed fashion. Can we perhaps come to how you guys will spend the winter together as cricketers and come then through the back door of the pavilion and talk about the social side?
Yeah, we will. We don't necessarily take it relaxed. This year we took it probably the most serious we've ever taken it because we introduced a coach. Christian Hunt was our coach. He was phenomenal for us throughout the year. Really helped everyone out. And if there was anything you needed doing, Christian was there. If it was running on some drinks or some sweets to keep the guys getting some energy, then he was always there to do it and obviously offering advice along the way. So we took it serious. We did take it serious. There was no way we were just turning up sort of tatters and still drunk from the night before, and there was no way we were taking it seriously. But no we were good friends. We're really good friends. I think there's no one in that team that I wouldn't regard as a friend, and that's really important. It's something that I haven't really experienced before, apart from playing. I had a team in Australia that I was very similar to that. When you get a good strong knit group of players that are good friends, it makes it very easy to play on the field, and then the social side takes care of itself pretty much from there.
Now, the setup at East Grinstead is slightly strange in that you are, as it were, lessees of the ground on a Saturday.
Yeah, we don't actually own the clubhouse. That's owned by a franchise company, Freedom Leisure, and they look after it. It's a sports and it's a sports club essentially. East Grinstead. We partner. We also share it with East Grinstead Hockey, who are very good at what they do. They're one of the strongest hockey teams in the country, if not Europe. And we share the clubhouse with them, and Freedom Leisure run it. So. But that doesn't mean the bar is not open. We definitely will go in there after a game and we will celebrate. I mean, if it means we just bowl into East Grinstead, then so be it later on at night. Or if not, get a cab down to Brighton.
What about oppositions? You imply that the social thing after the game is returning. Do oppositions stay?
Yeah, especially if the weather's been good. We've really asked teams to hang around. Obviously, it really
depends on the result.
Yeah, massively. I think if we've just smashed them, then, or they've smashed us, it's kind of either team will be a bit reluctant to do that. But we definitely ask the teams to come and hang around. We've had numerous times this year where we'd be having a jug of beer on the outfield, just sitting there, and we'll be literally mingling with the rest of the opposition. So they. It's a really good vibe when that happens, and it's almost going back to why you play the game. Exactly why you play the game. Mm. That's why I started.
So two things then, because I know Tim's going to want to ask you about the social programme. Before we do that, is Roger Dakin still involved in any way?
Yeah, Roger is there. He came to a lot of our games actually. He was really happy that we won the league. Obviously, he's such a character, and he came to all of the. Came to all of the semi-final, the quarter-finals of the national run, and he was really giving some to the dignitaries at Sussex to definitely come along and support us up there. Having an East Grinstead team this far in the cup is brilliant. I haven't had this for a while, so yeah. No, Rogers, he hangs around every now and then. Yeah.
Well, Roger's son Giles was a pupil of mine for a while. I've known Roger way back, and of course listened to him many times. Not just the story about when he was keeping a goal for England against Germany, I think is yeah. the story. Where all those goals went in, but yeah, known Roger a long time. I saw him at the RAC cricket dinner back in May, and he chaired Nick Compton, and they were both absolutely excellent. Good, well, I'm glad about that, but I know Tim has more than a passing interest in the social side.
Well, I'm just curious, because obviously lots of clubs these days have struggled to try and keep teams together and try and put on social events. Presumably you put on you have events of an evening, do you, on Saturdays at the club, and barbecues and things like that, do you, going on?
We have a social chairwoman who is Helen Heppel this year. She did an amazing job. Matt Heppel was the first team keeper. He actually started off the year as the second team keeper and captain, but we wanted him in the first team, and his wife took on the responsibility of doing the majority of social events. So we had curry nights, quiz nights, race nights. Mm. There were all sorts of things that we do, as well as sort of us organising things within our own sort of social groups anyway. But we kind of, I think leading into the year, we knew the social side of cricket was kind of fading out, and we knew if we could make everyone good friends and a strong, tight-knit group, then the cricket will... Mm. We're good enough cricketers, we can take care... That'll take care of itself. But if we sort of bicker and don't get on with each other and don't enjoy playing with each other, that's going to make it a really tough season. Because it's a long season. It's 16-odd games, and it's 16 weeks. It spans over a long time. So if you're not enjoying it, and you're turning up to enjoy it, that's the main reason you're doing it. You're not turning up because you have to. You're turning up because you want to, and you want to enjoy it. So we need to make that the most enjoyable we possibly can. We a few years ago, we introduced a club song. So it was something very, very simple for players. If you get the most wickets in the game or the most runs in the game, you actually get your name added into the song. Mm-hmm. We sing it, and we've filtered that song throughout the club. So knowing that if you come into the first team, you're expected to know the song, and if we win the game, we sing the song. And yes, we might annoy the opposition, but
banging on the wall, was it?
We don't care. We're smashing our bats on the ground, actually. So, but we don't care. Like, it's our song. It's now our identity, and it means that it's also given that involvement for everyone else in the club. So that if they do come in, you're literally in a circle, and you're with your mates, and you've won a game, and you have to celebrate after. We're not forcing drinks down people. We're just saying, be there. Just, you don't have to drink, you don't have to go crazy, just be there. And it's stemmed from that, really.
How many Saturday sides are you putting out at the moment?
Four.
Four.
I could be proven wrong, but I'm pretty sure it's four. Maybe five, but no, definitely four.
And afterwards in the sort of clubhouse, the four teams all mingling together, are they?
Well, they, like most cricket clubs around the world, there'll be a WhatsApp group, and we have one, and, and everyone's throughout the days getting updates from each team, who's doing what, how they're doing, and yeah, depending on where they are in the county, if they're nearby and who's at home, everyone will try and get back to the club. And it was a really successful year, not only for our first team, but we had our second team managed to fight relegation, but our thirds and fourths got promoted. So three out of our four teams won their leagues, which was amazing. So we were able to actually enjoy their success as well as them going, well, you won the Premier League. But yeah, it was a that's kind of how it works at East Grinstead. We do really enjoy each other's success.
So with a fair amount, clearly, of male bonding going on, Lewis, do the wives and girlfriends buy in and join in?
Yeah, they do, yeah. Especially at the we saw a lot of that more on the national games. There were cake stalls. Everyone was getting involved. Yeah, they definitely come along and support as much as they possibly can or want to, because obviously cricket's a long day and you've got to potentially enjoy it. But no, we've seen at any of the social events, they're all there, and it is really starting to become like a real family. It is really, really good.
It's clearly a winning recipe, if I may use that term, after you mentioned the cakes. You had some county T20 women's cricket a few weekends back, I believe. Is there any women's cricket in the club itself?
I believe we've had a section for a few years. If I'm brutally honest, I haven't seen much of it going on, but I know it's forming, or if not formed, and up and coming, especially with having things like T20 women's cricket coming. There's no doubt that it will get stronger, and that's one of our goals at East Grinstead. Again, we want more county cricket, whether it be women's, men's, anything, we'll take it. We want it. It's a lovely ground. I don't know if either of you have been there, but it's a lovely, picturesque ground, and the facilities are top-notch, really.
I played there very early on. You had an Australian overseas who made about 170 in a Sunday game and ruined the game. But that's a long, long time ago. That's probably 30 years back, just after it had been opened.
Okay.
And that actually prompts another question, Lewis. Do you have an overseas in the first team?
No, that actually is what made our season really special. We were able to say that not a single player in our team was paid, and everyone came from nearby. We had one lad called Brad Evans who was from South Africa, but he was merely here for study. We didn't pay him. He wasn't our overseas as such. He did have to class as overseas just through him not having a British passport, but we set out at the start of the year, we'd have myself and Finn, who had finished our Sussex careers, who were going to be available every week, and we kind of thought, well, if both of us are available every week, we don't need an overseas, and that for us, especially winning the league, I kept saying it to Roger, was the person I said it to, actually, Roger Dakin, and I said, this is really special if we do win this league, because to do it not paying anyone, not all local guys, it's not very often that you get that, and that again made it a little bit more special in my eyes, definitely.
I think it's incredibly special. Let me come right round the circle to something I aired a little while back, and we then went off on another tangent. What's the winter programme for the first team players?
That's a good question. I know for a couple of them they're looking at their fitness. They're going to get a bit more in shape. Like everyone, you just chill now. Everyone will just relax. I'd hope till the new year. Definitely don't want to be anywhere near a cricket bat and ball for a little while. Nice to just relax and go and not think about you get your weekends back, maybe go play a little bit of golf, winter golf, but yeah, everyone will go. I think maybe a couple of them going abroad. Some guys will actually be going abroad and doing some cricket in Australia, South Africa, and then winter nets will start again, I'd say roughly around about end of March, April time. And then the guys will be ramping it up, and we'll pick it up. I think the season starts May. That's when it starts. So
you mentioned, I think you mentioned briefly earlier that you'd been in Australia, you'd played cricket in Australia.
Yeah.
How does the East Grinstead setup compare to the experience you had in Australia?
Well, I did 4 years. I did four seasons in Adelaide and played A grade cricket out there, and it was a great experience. I'd any youngster who's sort of coming, umming and ahhing whether they want to do uni or take a gap year. I say, if you play cricket, definitely take your gap year and go to Australia, go play, or South Africa, wherever you go, go and experience it, because it's phenomenal. And the setup at the club I was at, and I know it was the same for most clubs in the area, was so professional. Just to see people, it wasn't, again, you weren't forced to go to any training sessions, but people just turned up because they knew that if they didn't, they weren't being picked. And I think it's still more professional than in England, because, and I think that comes from the fact that we play more. We play every week. We play only one day. Over there, you play two-day cricket. So you play the Saturday, the following Saturday, or Saturday, Sunday, and then you go again the next week. And if you're a batsman, you think about it, you may not have a hit for like 3 weeks. So there's real lack of opportunity in cricket out there. So it means that guys work hard. They train a little bit more. Because that's when they're getting their chance to actually play the game a bit. Whereas here, you get a low score as a batter, or you don't take any wickets as a bowler, you know you're getting a go the next week. You know it's your chance again the next week. And that's kind of the difference you see. So they do take it.
I was going to say, I've never been to Australia. I don't know about great cricket. I've read about it. It's meant to be a tough sort of environment. There's a lot of sledging and that
if you're
sort
English
of stuff.
Yeah, especially if you're English, yeah. you get it. I mean, I got it straight away from they can see how pale you are as soon as you come in. They know you're English, and as soon as you open your mouth, yeah, they're definitely on you. But it is a harsh environment. They've played it for so long at such a level. It's no real reflection on their professional game. I believe our professional game in England is as strong, if not stronger. And obviously our international team, we're going to find out over the winter how we're matching up with Australia right now. But I believe that, again, they're very similar. But from a club level, they're far more advanced in their thinking and how they go about it. But the social side of it, I think we've almost mimicked it, especially East Grinch did. And it might be tougher to do that in England because there are so many clubs. I mean, you just have to look over in Sussex, Surrey, like just how many clubs there really are. You go to, again, I'll use Adelaide as an example. There's only 13, 14 A-grade sides, so grade teams. And then below that, you have your turf competitions. And it's not that many people playing the game. So just the amount of people can really just change the attitude.
Do you think either consciously or subconsciously you've sort of taken your experiences in Australia, sort of put them into East Grinstead, and that's part of the reason that maybe East Grinstead has performed so well this year?
Well, fundamentally, our song that we built we've rejigged the lyrics from my song from my team, was myself and my brother who came up with it. So we definitely took, my brother was able to come out and experience it with me. And I said to him, he came out the second year I was out there, and I said, look how this is done. And he goes, yeah, we need to instill this back home. If we can try to find a way. And it didn't, we came home and we introduced this song, and everyone was like, what is this song? Like, no, we're not having this. And eventually drip fed it in, like forced people at the start, and then no, and it's just blossomed. It took about 3-4 years for it to really take off. But we were able to take a lot of the ethos that I saw in Australia and how the work ethic that they had, and you can try and bring it over. Again, I think you're never going to mimic it because the attitudes are, again, completely different. It's not, cricket is their second sport because AFL is huge out there. And in England, cricket just falls so far behind football and it's sort of par with rugby. And it's just not got the image that it has out there. So it's tough in that sense, but...
Lewis, as an opening bowler yourself and as someone with broad experience in Australia, I'm sure you're well aware that a new code of laws comes into force at the beginning of next month. Quite a lot of changes. We're going to be talking about some of those in the last half hour of the show tonight. And the reason I mention that now is that there is a whole new Law 42 about players' conduct. And the old Law 42 becomes Law 41, fair and unfair play. And I just wondered, in terms of your Australian experience and in terms of the necessity for this vast new Law 42, which doesn't just cover players' conduct, but involves four levels of sanctions on the field, umpires with cards for the first time, and so on and so forth. I just wondered, as a fast bowler who's entitled to a bit of fire and brimstone, how you feel the overall standard of what the old-timers would have called manners is in the Premiership in Sussex?
Yeah, it's... I think it's a really fine line. I simply draw it at the line. If you're directing, if you're going above and beyond sort of what... Let me put it this way. If you're just annoyed at what's going on with yourself, where do you draw the line between the anger that you can show at yourself, how you're bowling, how you're performing, and your what you would probably see as unfairness in the results you're getting? Oh, someone's just missed a good length ball and not nicking it, sort of thing. Where do you draw the line between general frustration and how you look physically, because that's all they're going to judge you on what you're doing, saying, with yourself, or whether it's actually directed at someone, especially an umpire? As soon as you direct any anger verbally, physically, definitely not at an umpire, that's when I think you draw a line. We had a couple of occasions this year where guys were getting in the heat of the battle, which you naturally do. We want to take wickets, we want to get these guys out, and someone will say something, and it is at the batter, and it's not personal, it's not direct. You know that if you're going to come off, they're going to shake hands, they're going to be okay, they'll see each other in the bar. And the umpires can intervene sometimes, and they'll go, well, we need to calm this down. And I just think there's got to be a line drawn where you go between, yes, the game, it can be tough, and it can be hard, and it's going to create characters, and it's going to create the toughness that it needs, and it should have, to being a little bit too soft, and we're just going to throw yellow, red cards and everyone who says a little peep at someone. I think there has to be a line drawn. For me, it is when you are directing some of that abuse, whether it be physically, verbally, at an umpire straight away.
I think the point you made about it getting personal was a good point. I think when bowlers, I mean, you know, if I've been batting and a bowler's having a go at something because I'm not batting very well, I don't have an issue with that.
Yeah.
If they start making personal comments, then I think you've stepped over that. I don't think any batsman would be particularly bothered if he's having a bad knock that a bowler starts taking the mickey out of his batting. I don't think there's an issue with that.
No.
I think you're right with... There is the line there, and you're right, you cannot direct it at the umpires. But I think once things become personal, that's when a line has been crossed. But
yeah, it's a tough one, and I think with this new law, I'd need educating in it. You've just mentioned it, but I'm not aware of it too much. But I did know about the yellow and red cards or whatever it was going to be. And but it'll be just interesting to see how the umpires, because umpires, especially in league cricket, again, they're doing a thankless task, really.
Yeah.
If you do a good job, you've done your job. Mm. If you do a bad job, you just an idiot. You're just another one. Mm. And it's a really thankless task. So I kind of see, you just need common sense. Like you were saying, if it's personal, you can see in someone's body language on a field if someone actually is not trying to sledge, in the old terms, like if they're actually trying to be personal. You can just see in their nature. I think the more aware umpires are of that, and just give them a little warning to start with, and if they carry on, then go. But obviously, if they do step over the line straight away, then yeah.
I think you're absolutely right. Speaking with many years' experience, I do feel that a talent for man management is ever more important in umpires, and not just at senior league level either. It's so very, very important to be able to defuse rather than inflame a situation, and that's where sometimes, you know, a little bit too much on the officious side of things can cause a few problems. Well, it's fascinating to hear that, particularly from an opening bowler, because you know, that's an instance where a little bit of leeway might be given. And from the personal point of view, I think the demerit point, or whatever it was called, that Ben Stokes got for swearing at himself was absolutely ludicrous, and I think most of the pundits thought so too.
I think it's the batters as well. I think the batters get a tough job as well when they can show annoyance at themselves. They can show, oh, why did I play that shot? How have I got out there? Rather than, and that can be misinterpreted sometimes by the umpires as, oh, he's really annoyed at my decision. I'm going to give him points, and I'm going to, and that happened a lot. I know that definitely happened a lot, and even at the professional level, that was a really tough one, really, really tough one, because then there's cameras on you as well.
Well, how many times batsmen walk out shaking their head because they're frustrated, as you say, they're frustrated at themselves, not at a decision that's been made. They're shaking at their head at themselves, but that could easily be interpreted as, well, he's annoyed with the decision, when in fact he's not. He's just annoyed with himself.
Yeah, I kind of even think there's the whole big one at the moment. It's like waving your bat. I hit it or I didn't hit it, the sort of thing. There's now saying that as soon as a batsman waves his bat in a gesture that he didn't agree with the decision, bang, you give him points. I would kind of then start to interpret it, look, if he opens his mouth and starts saying to the umpire, I need to hit that, and going against the decision verbally, then do him. But I think a little bit of, like, it's so grey, yeah. It's common sense, yeah. And it really depends on the personality of the umpire at the time, how he feels about it as well.
I think you'll find that, the red and yellow cards are actually a metaphor. There are not going to be red and yellow cards. There are going to be four stages. And level 3 and level 4 on-field offences are going to result in time partial removal from the pitch, a bit like sin-binning in rugby union, and a level 4 offence will be carpeted for the match and no further participation. I would imagine that the umpires association has certainly been consulted by this all the way through the process at the MCC, and I would imagine that umpires will display a lightness of touch, at least I hope they will. Lewis Hatchett from East Grinstead Cricket Club, time has absolutely flown. Thank you so much for your reflections this evening. We could have gone on for much longer, I'm sure. But from both of us, many congratulations on the club's success and the First 11's success. And we hope that you or one of your compadres will come back and see us in on the front foot next season.
Thank you very much, guys.
Well, it would have been wrong not to play Son of My Father tonight with Jimmy Anderson in mind. We'll be talking about things in the wider sphere in the last part of the show. Susie. Welcome back to part two of this Tuesday's On the Front Foot. My name's David J. Tim Bowling's with me here in the studio. Absolutely fascinating to hear Lewis Hatchett's views from East Grinstead about life, the universe and everything. And seems to me, Tim, that there's really every reason why East Grinstead should have been so successful this year.
I mean, you could tell exactly when Lewis was talking that the camaraderie amongst the players, the fact they've got the core of players, which turns out every week. Obviously, Lewis has been in Australia. You could tell that he had a slight twang to his accent. He brought some of that stuff back to East Grinstead. It was pretty clear that East Grinstead were going to have a good season this year.
Indeed, and so they did, and they won the Premiership. Our second guest this evening is James Lack, Master in Charge of Cricket at the Grammar School in Reigate. James, good evening. Welcome to Susie 103.4.
Hi, David. Thanks for having us.
It's brilliant to have you here. Now, tell us first and foremost, before we talk about cricket at the Grammar School and all that goes with it, how you came by your new job, because it's been your first year in post.
Yeah, so job was advertised in around March last year, and I applied and was fortunate enough to get it. And it's been a bit of a whirlwind ever since, really. So
it's a big responsibility, says he who knows, from days long, long ago when Tim was a pupil. We've got three Rigations around the desk now. And what do you think were the immediate challenges back in the spring before a ball was so much as bowled?
A bit of an unknown quantity as to what sort of our strength of opposition was going to be like in relation to the teams that we had. Yeah, just the nervousness around kind of we put together a winter training programme and whether we were going to see the benefits of it.
And what does your winter training programme consist of? Is this something that involves all age levels?
Yeah, absolutely. So all of the age levels were training from sort of January time onwards. However, we started with our senior group after October half term, because in February we took them to Dubai, where we had a very successful tour, won 4 out of 5 games, and it gave us an opportunity to then look at them in the playing context, come back after our tour and work up to Easter and over pre-season on things that had come up.
I do speak with a little bit of insider knowledge, but what did you make of Dubai, quite apart from results, as a venue for a pre-season tour?
Oh, it was ideal. The hotels that we stayed in were ideal for the boys. Facilities, especially at the Sevens set-up, which was fantastic. Couldn't have asked for more, really, and fortunately enough, I've been on tours before where it's been far too hot and you get to the fourth and fifth game and the boys are knackered. We had really nice temperature all the way through, which meant that we were able to sustain our level of performance throughout the tour, which was really good.
I thought it was quite an impressive place, not just on the field, but off as well, in spite of the things that you might have thought of as not perhaps being so easy to indulge in. But let's stay clear of the social side, since it's lads that we're talking about this time. Did you play under lights when you were in Dubai?
Yeah, we did. We played a game against the Sri Lankan Cricket Academy under lights just outside of Dubai, which was a different experience for a lot of the guys. They hadn't had that opportunity before, and it was good fun.
Was that with a white ball, or did you use a pink ball?
No, pink ball, coloured clothing, black sight screens. Yeah, no, it was good fun.
I did a game under lights at the ICC Global when we were out there in 2013, and 80 degrees in old money at 10 o'clock at night, and you're still playing under the lights. It was a tremendous experience, and we even asked for the old red umpire's shirts like the pros wear, so that was quite fun. But it was a white ball back then. What do you make of the pink ball? Do you use it much in schools cricket, James?
Yeah, most of our T20 cricket is pink ball. We have a fairly standard HMC pink ball that we use for all of that. It holds up reasonably well over 20 overs, but not much more after that, and the state it's in at the end of that 20 overs is that's kind of done, really. So
I did some national T20 cricket, I think it may have been for Phil Mann, I'm not sure now, down at Hurstpier Point College 5 or 6 years ago, when these pink things really were in their infancy. And first thing on a cloudy morning, about 9:30 in the morning, talk about go round corners. Mm-hmm. It was like Lord's this last week. It was just hooping.
Yeah, absolutely.
So do you buy pre-season, and did you inherit a set-up in terms of fixtures, or were you able to have some influence yourself from the start?
Yeah, absolutely. There was a setup that was in place, but one of the things that myself and Phil Mann, Director of Sport, agreed upon before kind of we started was that we were going to enter a league, basically. So Seven Oaks, Sutton Valence, Eltham College and the Judd School over in Tunbridge invited us to join them in a league setup where all our age group fixtures would go into the league format, and that meant picking up a few schools that were new to us, and it was a really good experience. Certainly our under 15A's and first team, who ended up winning their respective leagues, really sort of took to it as a format, and it put a bit more meaning on the game that they had to play, and we won the overall league between the five schools as well, which was a great achievement.
I'm not going to put you on the spot about exam pressures and so on, because I know even from the old days how difficult that can be for a master in charge of cricket. How do you think the relative importance, perhaps in educational terms as well as cricketing terms, how do you think the relative importance pans out between under-15s who are still there in school relatively, I stress relatively, free of pressures, and the cricket at under-18, under-19 level?
Well, we were fortunate enough that the grammar has moved to the linear A level. So a lot of the lower sixth were free from ASs, which actually meant if push came to shove, I was always going to be able to get a lower sixth side out. At the same time, I had a really good set of upper sixth boys who we were very proactive in putting together timetables for them, and we kind of knew that they would miss the odd match here and there. And it was the same with the GCSE guys, really. We had some guys that were willing to find that balance. And we certainly achieved that. I mean, we never named the same 11 two games running, but we didn't really ever pick out of the squad that we had in mind. So from that point of view, we got away with it. And again, about being proactive really, really helped. The other element that goes with it is Neil Rollings, who's the he runs Independent Coach Education, which is sort of where independent schools can get CPD. He wrote a brilliant article which was released in the Easter about kind of the levels of concentration needed in cricket are very similar to that in what you require for your exams, and actually it's a fantastic opportunity to kind of put those skills into practice whilst at the same time being able to run around. And even with our second 11, they played a 20-20 pretty much every Saturday morning, and all right, only T20, but at the same time that's 11 guys or more who were taking part in a bit of physical activity during study and helping to find that balance. So
I think we've spoken about that before, David, haven't we, where there tends to be this sort of whole pressure that you've got to just study, but actually to get out, have a game of cricket or whatever it is, some sort of physical activity can help immensely when you're trying to study anyway. So it's always a great thing to be able to actually take just a couple of, especially with T20, a couple of hours out, do that, makes, I think it makes a big difference.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the Grammar's got a big push on its welfare and the way in which it looks after, you know, the students that's in its charge. And yeah, that kind of individual nature that we went down from point of view of every single person's exam timetable and when we knew, identified when they would be under pressure, kind of providing that individual element really assisted them with that. And we emphasised the importance that it was. And we were fortunate enough to have a good group who wanted to play cricket, so it was about helping them find that balance and making it work for all parties involved. So,
can I ask, and again I'm not putting you on the spot here, and please don't be negative about anybody, at the moment would you say you enjoy broadly positive parental support and attitude?
Yeah, absolutely. First team this summer, we had a lot of the parents would come down, certainly towards the end of the game, and watch or be there at the start, which was good. As you always find, the younger age groups, parents are very enthusiastic and keen, and they were very well supported at the under-12s and 13s. Our 15s had a really good season and had a lot of support all the way through. And even the 14s, when they were playing, they had a lot of away games. They still had some good parental support that travelled with them, and yeah, by all accounts, it was pretty supportive, to be honest.
And of course, I suppose it's the case, we talk about pressures on youngsters with exams. Adults lead much more complex and pressured lives as well than was the case maybe 40 years ago when I was more or less in your shoes, James. So things do change. It certainly sounds to me as if you may have found a particularly productive use for information systems, which I suspect are not always quite as productive as some would like them to be. But if you can identify pressure points from timetables and so on, I think that's absolutely brilliant. You've now had 1 hour out of two on the front foot, our Suzy Radio Evening Cricket Chat Show. Lewis Hatchett here earlier from the highly successful East Grinstead Cricket Club, and our guest, I think probably for the rest of the show, is James Leck from Reigate Grammar School. We're going to talk a bit more, and then in the last third of the show we'll broaden things out. We have got another show up and coming before the end of the month, we hope, to discuss some of the wider issues, but we'll see where the thread of conversation takes us. You're with On the Front Foot from Suzy 103.4, Real Local Radio for Redhill, Reigate, Hawley and Crawley. Suzy Radio. Welcome back to the second and final hour of this Tuesday's On the Front Foot. Our guest is James Leck, the new master in charge at the Grammar School in Reigate. If you'd like to get involved in the show, there are two ways of doing so this evening. You can text us 07480 025010, or you can pop us a tweet at Suzy Radio. I suppose the email's up and running too. The email is studio@suzyradio.com, S-U-S-Y radio, all one word. Well, we certainly want to talk about Jimmy Anderson, Chicory Tip, earlier on as we get towards the end of the show, but some more about cricket at the Grammar School and the trials and tribulations of its new master in charge of cricket. Gentlemen, I don't want to take us off at a tangent just now, but listening to Dreadlock Holiday makes me think of an article I read at the weekend as to whether the final of the Caribbean Premier League or the third Test match at Lord's was more important in the eyes of the West Indian cricketing public. I don't know whether you've got any views about that.
I think, well, it's difficult, isn't it, at the moment? There's a lot of those West Indian players, certainly, who have taken T20 as being by far and away the more important type of cricket, which is why we're missing players like Gale and such like from the West Indies team, which perhaps, you know, when you look at how they performed, much better than they should, well, they were predicted to perform. I think even with someone like Gale in the side, they would have done better. However, T20 has become, again, a hugely important, and I guess with a lot of the West Indian viewers having latched onto baseball and basketball, they're looking for that much shortened version, and if it brings West Indian cricket back up, maybe it's a good thing.
Yeah, it was a case of who wasn't there. I mean, you mentioned Gale, but Marlon Samuels is another one who has a fantastic record against England. We all know that. Remember that salute with Stokes. And even, you know, Narine not playing, you know, probably one of the best spinners in the world. Is all the talk before the start of the series from Law and Holder was who's not here, and it's all about us and who is here. But, yeah, bravos as well. Some big names.
Well, we'll come back to the whole England show in the last bit of the programme tonight. Having asked Lewis earlier on, James, from his perspective as a first 11 league opening bowler, I wonder what you think about and what your attitude is to manners on the field of play at school level, particularly given that these new laws are about to come in with these four levels of sanctions.
Well, the spirit of cricket kind of goes without saying, and if you're not prepared to play according to that, then, you know, we need to look at whether you should be involved or not. Certainly kind of didn't really come to any issues for us in the summer, and it's something that is constantly, you know, on our minds from the way we want to get our messages across as far as how the team should play and behave and act, and it helps when you've got a good bunch of boys who are willing and understand that and want to play according to that. So,
and I think from my perspective, talking again to Lewis earlier on, I think from my perspective, having been a schoolmaster umpire for the whole of my career, I've now hung the white coat up completely, thanks largely to the new code of laws, I think. But it's so very important that you have umpires, especially school first 11, when you've really got young adults playing, who have got a real empathy for those players and understand that it's not just about tooth and nail, it's still about education when it's school cricket.
Yeah, absolutely. And we had some fantastic umpires who were very open to that kind of conversation before in the lead up to fixtures, and who were very good then on the day when we had them. So
that's excellent. Now, I know that in terms of talking about individuals, we all have to mind our P's and Q's these days in terms of child protection, quite rightly too. So perhaps before we talk about the team and the prospects at RGS for, it may still be 9 months away, but for the coming season, James, does state school cricket fit into the grammar school's scheme of things at all? Is the grammar school able to offer anything to the state schools within its community? And what sort of a relationship do you have with the clubs?
So, as far as the state side of things is concerned, coming in, my role was very much to sort of look inwardly and to try and see where school cricket was at RGS, and then we could then kind of go from there. Having done that, and sort of tried to establish ourselves, and I understand the setup now and how we're going to go about doing things, it's certainly something that we can look at from the point of view of helping and getting involved and offering masterclasses, use of our facilities, etc., to those schools that are around us. As far as the club setups are concerned, you may be aware that myself and Rugget Priory Cricket Club with Tom Lister, who's head coach down there, we've sort of got the club and the school together, and the club are using our facilities, and Tom Lister and a couple of other guys are coming in and helping us out on the coaching front, and that partnership is hopefully going to develop and grow, and there's a number of different avenues that can go down. It's not necessarily exclusive either. We're potentially looking to get involved elsewhere and essentially try and keep these kids playing cricket. Ultimately, our job as a PE teacher in the grand scheme of things is that those children, those young adults, by the time they leave our care, you know, go off to university or into adult sport and are being physically active. And if that's in cricket, then all the better.
I think that's an absolutely excellent tie-up. That's wonderful news to hear. Do you find with the league set-up that some of your junior sides are now involved in, as you told us earlier, plus the competitive nature of the East Surrey Colts League, do you find there are ever clashing commitments between school and club?
No. So myself and Tom Lister sat down very early on in the process and looked at training nights, looked at fixture nights for both the school and the club. And we looked at those key individuals that would be sort of targeted for both. We essentially designed our schedules accordingly so that there was as few clashes as possible. And I don't think it was necessarily ever a problem. There was the odd occasion where an individual would leave from a school game that finished, you know, at Hartswood at 5:30 and would be playing probably down the road at 6:15. But yeah, we tried where possible to make that work, and that's one of the benefits of setting up a partnership and just talking and communicating about it to keep things
I think it's good that you've actually sort of formalised the relationship, because, I mean, I was at Reigate Grammar many, many years ago, and there was always a sort of informal relationship between the school and the club. I remember playing in a Surrey Cup final at the Oval for Reigate Priory, and it was on a school day. The entire Reigate Priory team that went down there was Reigate Grammar School pupils, so much so that the Grammar School sent a teacher with us, I think, just to make sure we'd actually turned up at the Oval to play the actual game. But it's good that it's actually been formalised, because, like you say, it benefits club, benefits the school. It means that you don't have those clashes, which did happen back when I was playing. So I think it's good news for both. And obviously it benefits the club, because you can push all your players through to Reigate Priory, and they've got a steady stream of new players coming in.
And also, you know, we made it clear to the clubs that obviously they would be playing the school cricket on the Saturday, but they knew when the half-term Saturdays were. We knew when they were, the club knew when the boys were available, certainly the seniors. And a lot of us 15s and upwards have played adult cricket over the summer, which is great and keeps them involved. So from that point of view, yeah, you're absolutely right.
James, let me chuck you another relatively hot potato. What about girls' cricket at RGS?
Yeah, so it was, again, part of the remit. It's been happening previously before I arrived. We offered girls' cricket on a Tuesday after school for some under-13s, and we entered them into the sort of ECB, like Surrey National, like Cup, as it were. Yeah, that club continued after the sort of round of matches. And is, yeah, certainly something that's on our radar. We look to go with the 15s and the 13s potentially this summer. It's just a question of trying to enthuse the girls and take them away from, well, find a balance with athletics and tennis and rounders and everything else that's going on. So
there are always clashing commitments, and inevitably the good sports people want to play everything when they're 14 absolutely. Years old, of course, and life's so short and cricket takes so long, as one of my pupils said to me about 30 years ago, standing on what's now your cricket ground. James, so far as you're comfortable, tell us about the team going forward and what your plans are for the winter and the season of 2018.
So, yeah, got a big upper sixth cohort this year, which really helps. You often find the strength of your side revolves around how many players who are 17, 18 in the upper sixth. It makes a real impression on your opposition and kind of stands you in good stead. It's a really good group, and it's reasonably well supported by lower sixth and then a load of guys in their GCSE year. So from that point of view, sort of position is healthy as far as squad size is concerned. As you'll know, we've had the acquisition of Sam, who came from Whitgift, which has been fantastic for us and also for him. He has grown and changed and developed as a person for the better, and as you're aware, has played a lot of second 11 cricket over the summer for Surrey and is heavily involved in their academy set up with Gareth Townsend. Obviously, you know, key part of our side. Ash was another one who came in with him, came over from India, who's a fine acquisition, you know, 500 runs, and is going to captain the side next year. Harry, main bowler, sort of 140 overs in schoolboy cricket and taking 35 wickets is not a bad feat for a dibbly-dobbly seamer. There's some good sort of star names, if you like, but there's a lot of youth coming through, and there's a young lad, Will, who is his 16s now, but he scored 500 runs for the under-15s over the summer and played a lot of cricket for the Priory, scored his first ton the other Sunday for the Cavaliers. So there's a lot of promise sort of coming through, and we're quite hopeful, really.
So that's good. And briefly now, and then we'll move on to widen the discussion out into all things cricket in the last part of the show, James. What about places that you've played at so far with the Grammar School? You've got your own lovely facilities down there in Dover's Green Road. Anywhere you've been that's particularly struck you as this is a nice place to play as well as a good standard?
Yeah, I mean, the league setup was great. We were fortunate enough to play three of our four games at home. But we went to Sutton Valence, who played a sort of an out ground, which was used by a club, which was beautiful. Lovely thatched roof pavilion and lovely setup. You may or may not be aware, I'm an old Caterhamian myself, which did come up at interview, and Caterham is obviously a fantastic place now with its new pavilion. We didn't go there this summer, but we're going there next summer, and thoroughly looking forward to that. It's a fantastic setup in the old chalk pit, as it were. John Dodwell has a cracking setup down there, head groundsman. So, yeah, looking forward to going back there. Otherwise, yeah, we had a lot of home games this summer. Which was really nice. Took a load off on the travelling, but yeah, looking forward to going away to places like Sevenoaks, which I know have got great setups, and potentially picking up the likes of King's Canterbury, St John's, and Epsom. So all of which are lovely grounds, and yeah, should be good.
You mentioned St John's; they're one of the independent schools which has got heavily involved in promoting state school cricket through the offices of the 40 Club, of which I'm still technically a member, although no longer a playing member and barely a social one, given the cost of London dinners these days. But Adrian Gale, who I think has probably retired now from St John's staff, but a big noise in the 40 Club, has really been instrumental in starting the State Schools 2020 Day at St John's, and that's obvious. Worked very well. Are you still doing your little under 12 and under 13 six-a-side tournaments?
Yeah, absolutely. They were very well attended. Over 20 schools, I think, for both of those events. We also ran an under 10s tournament. Got rained off, but was fully in place to happen, to try and target some of those potential feeder schools, but also the local sort of state schools as well. Definitely in the plans to do it again next year, and we just hope we get the weather for it this time.
Well, with two Cateramians and three Rigations sitting around this very small table with three microphones, this is almost getting a little bit incestuous. But as far as the grammar school job is concerned, James, you've clearly got your feet firmly under the table and your spikes into the turf. And we wish you every success with everything you have to do. When does winter practice start for you guys?
Well, fortunately enough, I get sort of 6 weeks off this time of the period, this period of the year. So after half term we'll kick in with the first team and potentially some stuff with the under 12s. But yeah, other than that, we'll kick off in January and go through to the pre-season. So
do you encourage the youngsters, do you have the opportunity to encourage the youngsters to look at something which I think has been an absolutely tremendous innovation and then development over the last 5 or 6 years on Sky Sports, which is the Zone and the coaching clinics? I think those have been absolutely revelatory.
Yeah, absolutely. They are. They're a fantastic resource and they're readily available. And yeah, a lot of the boys have got Sky and readily sort of enjoy watching those, and they get a lot from them. So
I think it's really interesting to see hard-bitten and hugely experienced pros like Mahela Jayawardena and Ricky Ponting really getting down to coaching level basics. It's brilliant.
I remember watching, there was, as a wicketkeeper, I remember watching a few years ago, Mark Nicholas did a similar thing before they brought it in as a sort of feature. They did a thing with Jack Russell, and it lasted about 25 minutes, and it was absolutely superb. And as a wicketkeeper, just, you know, learning so much from someone like Jack Russell with the sort of quirks of how he used to do things, and Mark Nicholas as well, asking questions of, why don't you do this, why don't you do that? He says, no, I do it this way. And it's brilliant, as you say, it's a brilliant way to actually pick up little tips that you'd never perhaps get from sort of normal coaches, if you like, to speak to these really world-class, or to see these world-class players, giving that information over is a massive benefit to players.
In your position, James, and yet again I'm putting you on the spot here, I suppose, what would you regard as the essentials, the basics for, say, an under 12 wicket keeper to pick up, and what sort of tweaks would you be looking to make with your first team keeper?
Well, the first team keeper is Sam, who's obviously on the books as Surrey, is effectively their third wicket keeper. You're always looking for good footwork and being able to move into the right positions. But the key that you really look for is for the keeper to stay down and to come up with the ball. And if they're coming up too early, or they're not going down the right line and getting their head in line with the ball, then they're going to struggle. So from that point of view, it's about keeping everything sort of within the core, all tightly together so that it all works together. And that, you know, usually happens with those sort of slightly smaller, compact individuals.
I suppose for schools cricket, the whole business and technique of slip catching, with so much overs cricket being played, is less relevant than it would have been years ago. Do the same sort of basics apply to slip catching? I'm just thinking in the way that the pros talk about relaxation first and posture second, perhaps, even though I'm sure they would be with you all the way. It's much, much easier to come up from down than do the other thing.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, when you're in that relaxed position and you have that opportunity where that you can give with your hands, if you are fixed and your elbows are firm and knees and everything, you are going to struggle. So
much of cricket's soft hands, isn't it, apart from bowling, really and truly.
Indeed.
Yeah. Okay, well, we've taken a look at what's going on at Hartswood and at the Grammar School, and we're delighted to hear all of that.
SusieRadio.com. Check it now.
Welcome back to the final half hour of On the Front Foot with David Jay and Tim Bowling, plus our guest James Leck, who's going to stay with us until 9 o'clock as we broaden things out and talk about the wider cricketing world. Tim, I think we're going to need that second show later on this month.
Yes, we are indeed.
For the whole wider world thing. But James, you've been eyeing my two cricketer magazines in the corner, which we're not going to open tonight, but you've got a little bit of news there for us.
Yeah, so lucky enough to have made the top 100 schools guide this year that will be in the Cricketer magazine in their December issue, which is puts a marker down for sort of the level that we're at now. So
I was intrigued to see the omission last time around and slightly surprised, I have to say. So that's tremendous progress. Well, gentlemen, let's move away from the world of junior cricket and let's approach England just for a moment via the Women's World Cup win, which is now pretty much ancient history, but also the more recent Women's Kia T20 blast, which seems in the wake of the World Cup to have struck a very positive note.
Yeah, I think, I mean, women's cricket seems to be on the up and up. I mean, the shows we've done this season, we've talked about women's cricket every single programme. Last year, I think we probably touched on it a couple of times, but this year, clearly, it's having a massive impact. Sky are promoting it more. You go on the BBC website, there's more information about women's cricket in general. It's obviously having a really, really positive impact on females, and hopefully it can carry on growing.
And they've clearly found a couple of very engaging broadcasters also. And as I said on a previous show, I think what's really important about it to me is that if Heather Knight or Tammy Beaumont or Charlotte Edwards, whoever has been in the Sky Pod or the Sky Box, they've just been colleagues. There has never been the slightest hint of gender discrimination, and everyone is a cricketer or an ex-cricketer. I really think it's on a roll, and pleased to see that Miss Beaumont and also Anya Shrubsole were coaching with Rob Key this last weekend on Sky Sports. It's been a revelation, James.
Yeah, it's exciting. I mean, I remember watching the World Cup final, and you know, you thought India had all but sorted it and got over the line, and then, you know, Shrubsole gets the ball and grabs the game by the scruff of the neck, and it's fantastic TV and entertainment. So the Super League seemed to get the kind of coverage and support that it deserved, and was a good standard. And hopefully it can be used as a bit of a launch pad to progress over the winter, potentially with ladies going down under or to South Africa or wherever, and coming back and kind of maintaining that, keeping that momentum going next summer.
And there I was at Lord's on Saturday watching England wrap up the West Indies, and Heather Knight ringing the bell and everyone knowing who Heather Knight is, and Anya Shrubsole in the radio box at lunchtime picking up the CMJ Spirit of Cricket Award from Aggers. So
I think that's the point. It's a good point. It's the fact that people know who they are now, not just a case of that they have to be introduced and everyone in the crowd saying, well, who are they? They actually know who they are, which is a big, big plus and a big, big progress, really.
And people people talk, obviously and quite rightly, about the role that Rachel Hayhoe Flint, God rest her, played in the past and in the development, indeed the establishment of a Women's World Cup before there was a Men's World Cup. The Women's World Cup came 2 years previously, in 1973. But I guess, chaps, that history will view Charlotte Edwards in a very similar light.
Yeah, I mean, the contribution that that she's made, you know, is just phenomenal, and it's no coincidence that the game is now starting to really, for women's cricket, to sort of blossom. So yeah, I mean, she's going to be remembered as a massive, massive name in the sport.
At the same time, you know, you have to look at how she has sort of stepped back from the international setup, which couldn't have been the easiest of things to do because of how much she'd given to it. But as it turns out, it was definitely, it seems to be the right decision, and was to the benefit of those younger players who had the opportunity, which they grabbed with both hands. So
it was almost poetic, wasn't it, in the way that Charlotte Edwards Vipers beat Heather Knight's Storm last year in the T20 final. Those roles were reversed this time around, whereupon Charlotte Edwards retired immediately. And I remember hearing Ian Botham say somewhere along the line that at the end of his playing career he just walked from one box into the other, from the dressing room into the commentary box, and it looks as if that's exactly what Charlotte Edwards is going to do. So I think she possibly gets our accolade tonight. A wonderful cricketer and a wonderful presence for England. Let's move on to the men's team. I sat and watched West Indies wrapped up rather too easily after that amazing match at Headingley. Tim, you were the other side of the world, and I had a social engagement on that last afternoon, but I do remember the very last bit almost that I watched when David Lloyd was commentating on Sky, and there came the point where he said, you know, they only need 244, and it went from there. I wasn't totally surprised. I didn't know until the following morning what had happened, because I was late in that night. But what an amazing test match.
But I mean, as you say, I was in Malaysia, so unfortunately I wasn't able really to follow it live. I read about it afterwards. But in many ways, as a diehard England fan, I don't think it's such a bad thing that the West Indies won that test. I've got a soft spot for the West Indies anyway, from an era where they were the number one test team in the world, and to see their decline over recent years has been heartbreaking. So any success for the West Indies for me is a plus. So I'm glad we won the series, but I don't think it was such a bad thing that they put up a fair bit of opposition, and it wasn't the walkover that, well, most people, I think even we'd sort of predicted in the last show we did, that England were going to walk this series, and it wouldn't provide any test before the Ashes. It clearly did, and fair play to the West Indies.
James, I've always thought that as world rugby needs a strong Welsh 15, world cricket needs West Indies.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you look at Anderson's past, you know, the Ambrose figure, and he's not far off Walsh. And you think of those two names, and you throw out Marshall, Sobers, Richards, Lara, Chanderpaul, and you think, you know, generation upon generation of fantastic West Indian cricket sides. Yeah, can only be good for the game if there is a strong West Indies team coming into the circuit. So
I was going to say, it's one of the saddest things, I think, when we had the Champions Trophy earlier in the season, and the fact there was no West Indian presence. I mean, I know that the rules are the rules, and those are the teams that are in it, but it's very sad that you know, they weren't there. They should always be in one of those tournaments.
Intriguing, James. We've been talking about your role and about schools cricket. I wasn't aware until he got his 200s at Headingley that Shay Hope is one of Alan Wells's products at St Bede's in Palesham in Eastbourne.
No, well, it's fantastic that. I mean, he showed a lot of character. Apparently, first player for a very, very long time, mainly 100 years or so, who scored 200s in a test match any first class match at Headingley.
That's the only time it's ever been done.
Indeed, there you go. So, he looks the part. Let's hope that the likes of himself and Gabriel, who obviously made a big difference when he came into the side, can pull those guys together around them and hopefully raise the level that they come to, you know, shores like England and go over to South Africa and Australia and compete.
We were hoping, you may not be aware of this, James, the new CEO of West Indies Cricket is Johnny Grave, who's an old Rigation. Indeed. We were hoping we were going to get him down, but unfortunately negotiations foundered rather as regards tonight. Still, not to worry. Yeah, strong West Indies, really, really important, I'm sure, and good to see. I think there's quite a strong connection between Barbados, is it, and St. Bede's at Hailsham, who really set themselves up as an academy. They wanted to rival Blanc and Eastbourne College and Brighton College and so on and so forth. Okay, well, what do we make then, gentlemen, of the seven test matches this summer, South Africa and then West Indies?
Well, I think England performed, certainly against the West Indies. I think Joe Root, I actually quite like the fact that he was declaring when he did and taking risks. I think for too long we've had... Certainly Alastair Cook has been one of those players who would be very reticent about trying to make declarations which would make games competitive. He'd often linger too long. I thought England performed well this summer. I thought, considering that we went into the West Indies series thinking it was going to be a walkover, we lost the second test. I think it's provided some tests for them to see how they are going to perform in the winter against Australia. So I thought we had a pretty good summer.
Yeah, it's obviously confirmed that there are seven or eight players who are, outstanding cricketers that we've done very well to produce and who can hopefully make their mark in Australia. I guess it's we need to look at our county system and is it necessarily producing the level and quality of player that we need to come in and fill some fairly big holes that there are still in that lineup. So.
I suppose before we come on to Aussie selection, which we must at least just dabble in before the end of the show, the Kookaburra ball and Australian conditions are bound to have an effect and possibly an adverse effect as well, with the swing going early and not much seam movement.
Yeah, I think, as James just said, the fact is that whether the county game will be able to sort of provide enough experience for some of those players to go to Australia with, as you say, the Kookaburra ball and so on and so forth. It's clear that there are certain players that came up from the county set-up into the England team, some of the new players who, whilst they were scoring hatfuls of runs at county level, as soon as they came into the England team, it was literally a different ball game for them. It's going to be interesting to see if any of those sort of newer-type players get thrown in at the deep end in Australia. I think Bayliss has said it's unlikely there'd be many new faces in that squad. It's not. I wouldn't have thought it's going to be the arena where you particularly want to make your debut, put it that way, in an Ashes series in Australia. So we'll see. It's going to be a tough winter. But then, who knows? We didn't think the West Indies would provide any opposition. Will England provide opposition for Australia? They've had their problems. They've had problems with players' contractual disputes and so on. So perhaps the Australian or England are in similar boats at the moment.
And Aussie have just lost a test in Bangladesh,
exactly,
although
yes.
We've
yep.
only got to go back 9 months to yep. see England doing exactly the same thing. I wonder whether it's symptomatic of a younger generation. And we've got some wonderful young cricketers. The lad who, Pollard, who opened the batting for Warwickshire in the T20 semi-final. And we've got the Curran brothers at the Oval, so on and so forth. I wonder if it is symptomatic of a generation where T20 has almost had the primacy in a lot of ways in their cricketing education, that both England and Australia are looking a little more fragile than they have done at 2, 3, 4, 5, maybe not 6.
Yeah, I totally agree. I mean, I think that the problem is now for cricket in general, T20 cricket is so important for the funds, for the money. We're talking about a city-based T20 tournament in England. There's T20 tournaments throughout the world. Many of these players aren't even interested in playing international cricket anymore. They can make their money from being mercenaries around the world at T20. So, yeah, it does impact on the level of quality, if you like, for all the test sides, England, Australia and other sides as well.
Yeah, we've talked about West Indies. I'm pretty sure that South Africa are going to come again, aren't they? They'll rise.
I would have thought so. Again, such a tradition of cricketing excellence, really. Again, with generations, Pollock, Donald, Boucher, Smith, Gibbs. It has to. And you look at the likes of Rabada coming through, and they're clearly doing something right still. And yeah, like you say, with the West Indies, it's as important for South Africa to be within the setup. Tim made an interesting point about allowing England players to go to places like Australia, etc., etc. And I think that's an interesting one of why they've picked Mason Crane in the squads recently, because they've obviously given him the opportunity to go to Australia. I think he played for New South Wales, and not just the grade cricket stuff. You know, he actually played some Sheffield Shield cricket. And I think those opportunities are happening more, and they're realising that that needs to happen. You also look at the fact that the Lions Tour is shadowing, and the likes of names potentially like Hamid and Jennings, who might not make the main squad but could go with the Lions, are only going to be, you know, a couple of hour flight away from, you know, potentially diving into the Test match arena. So I think they're starting, certainly since Andrew Strauss has come in as you know, director of cricket, I think there's certainly been a slightly more proactive approach, and give him some time, I think that could just extend even further. So
it seems to me that Strauss has managed to straddle that bridge between the negative impact of a recent player who might be too close to the squad and someone who's able to create, perhaps by his actual demeanour and attitude, create sufficient distance. Good luck to the lad. I think he's...
Yeah, I think it was a good point you're making. I mean, he's sufficiently young enough to have been involved with England cricket as a player recently, but he's sufficient... old enough, if you like, to have the experience and wisdom perhaps of being able to actually run the game from a slightly more distant point of view.
Yeah, okay. I've vaguely shunted a pen and paper in James's direction, because Tim, we need to give James long enough to scribble down his starting 11 for the first test down under.
I'll pass the pen and paper.
I don't need to scribble it. I can tell you it now.
Okay, fine. Well, if you know what it is and you're absolutely certain about that, you go first, my friend.
Well, you have to look at how England have selected previously, and I think there will be a certain level of consistency with that selection. Obviously, there was the big Sky Sports cricket show verdicts that happened on Sunday, where they looked at the squad, and as we've said earlier, there are some big holes in that middle order of the batting lineup. I think Stoneman's move from Durham to Surrey and how he's done in the last four years, the way he's shaped up in... against this summer and the Test side, I think he's earned the right to stay in the side up top. I think Cook naturally, obviously, picks himself. I think the big debate is the number three. I don't think Wesley has done enough. I think if you look at the Aussies, they will have potentially Khawaja or a Smith going in there, and I think both of them said it in the show. You know, we need Root coming in before the crises rather than in the middle of the crises. And I think, you know, if he's going to be the captain and the leader of this side, I think he needs to go to three. The interesting element then is who bats at four. And I think I was very convinced by Shane Warne's argument, but also because of the type of player that Alex Hales is. I think that... Indeed. I think that Hales does have a game suited to the faster bowlers, and I think we are going to need that counter-attacking approach. We talked about characters and individuals earlier. They certainly like David Milan, and I think he scored some ugly, gritty runs in the summer, and I think the faster pace pitches will suit his game as well. Then after that, I think the side pretty much picks itself. You know, I can't see them moving away from Stokes at six. Bairstow would keep with the gloves at seven and Ali at eight. They seem fairly set on that. There seems to be a bit of debate about Roland Jones and Wokes for the number nine spot, but it's a no-brainer. Wokes has to start as the play. No one really wants that England shirt more than Wokesy, I don't think. And then obviously, you know, nearly 1,000 wickets between them, Anderson and Broad. Pick themselves as well, so that's the 11 I would go with.
Tim, what have you got?
Similar to James, I've got Cook at one, Stoneman at two, Root at three. I agree with you, Hales at four as well. I think Hales has done enough in county cricket to warrant a recall. I know he's struggled at Test cricket, but I think he's been played in the wrong position at Test cricket. I think if he's dropped down to four, maybe even five, I think he could perform better. I think it's all in Hales's head, unfortunately. If he's just told to play his game, he'd be fine. You can see when he goes out in Test cricket previously that he's been nervous. He just needs to play his game, and I think he's got enough about him in Australia to be able to fill the number four role. I'd have Stokes at five, Bairstow at six, Moinelli at seven. Number eight, I would actually pick Liam Plunkett or Rashid, depending on whether we want an extra spinner. But I think Plunkett is a massively undervalued player. I think he always performs well for England. I don't understand why he's not been around the Test squad. I'd be very surprised if Plunkett starts for England, but he would be my number eight, as I say, or Rashid. And then number nine and ten is Broad and Anderson. Number 11, I would choose Wood, because I think on those pitches in Australia, he's quick enough that we need to scare some of the Australian batsmen. So, unfortunately, the likes of Roland Jones and so on would miss out. They'd be in my squad, but I would go with Wood at number 11 just because of his pace.
Right you are. I'm not going to attempt to do any justifying here because we're racing towards the end of the show. My choice, because I love being a devil's advocate, would be Cook, Hamid. Ask Stoneman to bat at three and let the captain have his way to start off with at four. Hales at five, and then, obviously, it picks itself from there on down, doesn't it? Stokes, Bairstow, Ali. I would start with Chris Wokes if he's fully fit, but I take the point about Mark Wood if he also is fully fit. So that's and you cannot do without Broad and Anderson. Let me do a little bit of devil's advocacy as we've got a few minutes, not many. A little bit of devil's advocacy. Gentlemen, is it conceivable that Stuart Broad's England race is nearly run?
Well, I think it's probably coming towards the end. I would say that he's certainly got another Ashes tour within him. I don't know. I think Broad's. I think there's probably he's got a couple more seasons within him. I don't know.
I think Broad is certainly one of those characters that you'd want to go into battle with, and often Australia brings out the best in him. Some would say the worst, but you want that competitive edge when you go down under. And I think Broad, like Cook, both very stubborn individuals who I think have probably potentially still got a point to prove that they are still good enough at the top level and will want to see it through. I agree with your point about Wood going. The big question mark is going to be whether or not the likes of Broad, Anderson, Wokes, Stokes, are they going to be able to bowl five test matches in a row? And certainly we're going to need that bowling depth. And certainly Wood provide that, but also he's had his injury problems. Plunkett is a fantastic suggestion as well, but at the end of the day, you look at wickets that have been taken in, whether they've been home or away, and Anderson obviously does very well at home. You need the Broad X factor.
Well, the thing is with Broad, he's been in the shadow of Anderson for probably most of his career. But what I like about Broad is as someone who's old enough to remember his father, there's a lot of his father in him. As you say, that stubbornness, that sort of just wanting to win, desperate to beat the Australians. Same as his dad. I mean, all right, he shouldn't have done it, but I remember Chris Broad smashing his stumps down, refusing to all this. I know it's not the done thing, but he had that fighting spirit, which you can see in Stuart Broad as well. So when Stuart Broad's race is done, I think it will be quite a sad day because he's been a massive servant of England, and him and Anderson in tandem have been absolutely superb.
James has touched on Jimmy Anderson and all of these figures. I mean, it is a unique achievement. And to do it in such a manner, knocking out the middle pole of someone who had given them real grief at Headingley, to wit Brathwaite, was and then to follow that up with a masterclass in swing bowling and his best ever career figures. It really is fairy tale stuff, isn't it?
Yeah, he's been amazing, hasn't he?
I think James Anderson sums up, say myself as a cricket coach and others, Anderson was told to change his action. They didn't like the fact that he was looking down and wasn't looking at where the ball was going. And, you know, people tried to teach the perfect model and tell him that he should be doing it like this. And actually, you know what? The guy knows what he's doing. Everyone is unique. Everyone's an individual. Everyone is going to do it differently and not necessarily perform it to that perfect model that you would desire. And actually, he's come through that. He has done it his way. And yeah, he might seem like a bit of an interesting character in the dressing room, but he's always spoken of fondly by those that he's around. And you look at the way that Bayliss and Farbrace have essentially, I would imagine, just left him to it. And, you know, he's obviously, you see it time and time again, his relationship with Otis Gibson has been fantastic throughout, who's obviously going to be a massive loss. But an exciting time for him and potentially, you know, the likes of Shane Bond and Donald being considered to come in could bring some new ideas. And I just think it's important that if someone has got that specific individual ability, that they're left to it, really, and not sort of mucked around with. So
who would have thought, though, that James Anderson would have been that he would have been that bowler that when he first started playing for England, he would have come on as well as he has. I mean, you know, when you think back to him playing sort of Burnley League cricket, thrust into the England team, and all of a sudden now, over the years, he's become this absolutely phenomenal bowler, taking over 500 wickets, which is just incredible, really. I mean, who would have thought that back then?
Absolutely.
We've got just 3 minutes, because time is flying, just consider, we won't have a chance to discuss them tonight, but just to consider the changes to the laws coming into effect from the 1st of October. Essentially, the new code of laws, this touches upon things we've been talking about tonight, new code of laws written in language applying to all persons regardless of gender, lots of he stroke she, and lots more use of generic terms like fielder and bowler. Interestingly, it was rubber stamped by Claire Connor herself, the term batsman remains. The handled the ball law has been deleted. Graham Gooch, I remember, in a test
match.
That's
right, punched the ball away, didn't he? Yep, that's right.
But not many besides that, and that will now be obstructing the field, so it's still a dismissal. That'll be a good quiz question. 10 dismissals reduced to 9 from the 1st of October. And the handled the ball law then has gone, and the lost ball law has been deleted. That's one thing I've never seen. In all my years of playing on village greens, I never saw a ball go down a rabbit hole and be called rabbit hole and called lost for 6 runs. The old law too, which is substitutes and runners, batsmen or fielder leaving the field, batsmen retiring, batsmen commencing innings, has been divided into new laws, 24 for fielders, 25 for the batsmen, and there's a new concept, or an amended concept, of penalty time, which I'm not going to attempt to go into now. Something that's been talked about a lot, Law 5, the bat, now places limits on the thickness of the edges and the overall depth. And in terms of somebody that James mentioned earlier on, Mark Boucher, Law 8 has been changed to allow specially designed mechanisms to tether the bails to the stumps, which is an interesting one. Tim, you were talking earlier in the season about replacements for injured players in the 11. Not thus far, but a substitute may now keep wicket officially with the consent of the umpires. And then the one that James was referring to off-air right at the start, protection for a running or diving batsman whose bat bounces up having already been grounded beyond the crease. I think that's the one that's most likely, with TV replays and all the rest of it, to be the biggest change. Now, deliberate front foot no balls will result in the bowler being suspended in the same way as beamers. The batsman may no longer take stance in a position where he/she will encroach on the protected area. So not just the bowler running on, but the batsman 5 foot down, unlikely. But
you never know.
It's taking stance.
Yeah.
It's not running down the wicket.
Yep.
And then, of course, non-striker risks being run out if he/she leaves his or her ground before the bowler would normally be expected to release the ball. Well, that's going to be a can of worms. What does normally mean? And then, of course, the whole of Law 42, player conduct. But we've been there several times over, so let's not go there again. It's time very nearly for us to clear the decks. James, have you enjoyed coming to see us this evening?
Yeah, thank you for having us. It's been great.
Well, it's been fascinating to have an insight into the world of school cricket. I'm very pleased to hear that you're managing to strike balances and compromises, because I think that's something that's perhaps been lacking for a while, and we wish you every success with that, and perhaps you'll come and see us again pre-season.
Absolutely.
Thank you ever so much for coming in tonight, Tim. We're almost there. Any final thoughts in the last 20, 30 seconds?
We've had a couple of great guests again tonight. We've had some good guests throughout the whole summer, but we've had two good guests tonight, so it's been a good show.
And we've got more than enough material for another show to wrap up this season.
That's right, yeah.
And then we'll look to do something when we're getting towards the beginning of the Ashes.
Exactly. So hopefully we'll do an Ashes special
as well. To keep things going in the winter. Tim, thanks ever so much.
Thank you, David. Nice to see you again.
And all that's left for me to do is to offer the thanks of On the Front Foot once more to James Leck, who's still here with us, and also to Lewis Hatchett from the successful, indeed the Premiership winning side at East Grinstead. And, of course, Tim Bowling, who does lots and lots of work in setting up this show, and his contribution should never be underestimated. In this last 30 seconds, just a reminder that East Grinstead and Newdigate of our regular contributors were winners. Reigate Priory and Hawley came third in their respective leagues, Outwood fifth, Merstham sixth, and we did touch on Burgess Hill with Tom Trowbridge, and sadly Burgess Hill were relegated. We'll let you know via social media and the website when the next show is. From On the Front Foot, it's a very good evening.